Welcome back to the Unschool Files podcast. I'm your host, Megan, and you are listening to Season 2, Episode 5. This season, we are hearing from folks in various self-directed education spaces who are on the ground in various models, using different tools and frameworks to meet the unique needs of their communities. This conversation I had is with Mel Campo from ALC NYC, also known as ALCNIC, the original and flagship Agile Learning Center. We discuss what is an Agile Learning Center, how they came to be, who came up with it, what are the tools, how are they used, what are the kinds of offerings that are available, and we get into all the nuts and bolts of ALCs. It's a really great conversation. Join me in welcoming Mel to the podcast.
Hello.
Hi, Mel.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good. I'm so excited that we finally found a time to connect.
Me too. A third time is definitely the charm.
For sure, for sure.
Welcome to the Unschool Files podcast. I'm really, really excited to be chatting with you.
Thanks. Such a pleasure to be here.
Why don't we get started with maybe telling the listeners a little bit about yourself and your connection to self-directed education?
Sure, absolutely. My name is Mel Campo. I'm an artist, a writer, a trans person, a rock climber, and for the last 7 years, I've been working as a full-time facilitator at the Agile Learning Center in New York City, ALC NYC. It was a job that really changed my life. I came into a lot of those identities, including artist and rock climber and trans person at ALC. So it was a really impactful place for me. And I'm currently living in the mountains and trying to figure out what I'm doing next.
Let's talk about your time at ALC NYC. Why don't we start by talking a little bit about your experience? You shared some really intimate details there at the top. How was that experience for you? You said you came into these knowings and new interests in that space. So why don't you talk about how that space supported that?
Absolutely. I guess let me back up a little bit. The way that I came to ALCNIC, as we like to call it, is I ran into somebody that I knew out in the world. I sort of studied self-directed education at college. I was a big idealist. My mom's an educator. And I started out in politics and realized like the system works the way it's supposed to. And so then I kind of veered into education. And when I did, I met Abby Olton, who I then ran into 3 years later, just randomly in New York City out in the world. And she was like, yeah, remember that school we talked about in college? Like, I run it now. And I was like, oh my God, are you hiring? Like, can I work there? And the thing is that, like, with ALCNIC, the way that Abby was running it, like, when you say yes, you really say yes. So she was like, sure, come to the school, come check it out, you know? And so, like, I was working a corporate job. I had this job in marketing. I was, like, losing my mind writing 40 marketing emails a week. And so I went to this school, and Abby was like, yeah, I'm fixing a shelf, but the kids will show you around. And so I got a tour from a pair of teenagers and a six-year-old, and I was like, this place is magic. I have to come here. So Abby and Ryan Schallenberger, who's the other co-director, and I worked it out. I left my corporate job, and they ran a facilitator training, which there's lots of ALF trainings all over, just like ALCs. The trainings are grassroots and locally organized. And so when I went to the ALC training, one of the activities, so the way that it worked was they did like 3 days of foundations. Maybe we did a week of foundations at that point. I don't remember, but like grown-ups sitting around talking stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they ran a week of just regular school and brought the kids in. And we call it bonus school. The kids all love to come, you know, like it's really exciting for them. Mm-hmm. And at bonus school, one of the things that Ryan was doing with the kids is that he was taking kids rock climbing. Mm-hmm. And there was this gym down the street. It was on 96th Street, RIP, Steep Rock Boulders.
Moment of silence.
Moment of silence for Steep Rock Boulders. It was actually like this great little tiny gym in a New York City storefront. Honestly, like I'm looking at the room I'm in, it wasn't much bigger than this. But I went, and I've always been really scared of heights and not very trusting of my body. Mm-hmm. So I'm at this thing, I'm like way out of this comfort zone. And I have this like, I have this very vivid memory of being near the top of the wall at a place where still to this day, years later, I often bail out. And there was this kid underneath me who was like, you can do it, Mel. And I was like, I gotta just try. I can't just give up while this kid is watching me. And so I tried, and I remember finishing the climb. And I was so scared, but I was like, wow, I can do this. And so I'm still chasing that feeling for sure. Because at the same time that that happened, a friend of mine joined a rock climbing gym in Brooklyn where we both lived. And she was like, I met all these queer people there. You should come with me. Every Tuesday night, we just hang out and then we eat burgers afterwards. And so like those two things happened at the same time. I started at ALC rock climbing and my friend started rock climbing. So I was like, all right, I guess I'm going to do this activity now. And that's it's wonderful. Funny because, yeah, it's really worked out in hindsight because that friend met her current partner in that rock climbing group, and they're getting married this October. And I met my partner at that rock climbing group. Oh. And we've been dating for 3 years now.
That's so wonderful. So, I've been quietly watching this journey on Instagram, like long before I ever even knew you were connected to ALC NYC, which is funny. Uh-huh. Figured that out later, but it's really cool watching you like try and film yourself like celebrating yourself and film yourself playing. And I think that that is precisely what self-directed education like brings out of us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that you bring up playing because that's so important. For me, like a lot of my schoolishness manifests in wanting to be like perfect at something, you know, or mm-hmm. only wanting to do things that I'm good at naturally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was a straight A student. Like I really have a lot of, you know, I was on the high honor roll for every semester from sixth grade to 12th grade, except for one, you know, and I'm 31 years old and obviously I'm not still upset about it, you know, like these like schoolish habits really like get down deep inside of us. And the thing about rock climbing is that I'm not very good at it. Like naturally, like I mentioned, I'm scared of heights. My proprioception is not something that I've been working on my whole life, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't really know where my body is. I have PTSD, like diagnosed PTSD from some events in my childhood. And so, you know, sometimes when I get scared, it triggers an emotional flashback. And so sometimes I'm like out on a rock somewhere and I have to be like, hey, person who I'm out with, like, I'm, you know, just having a flashback. Like, it's okay. It's not about the rocks, you know, like,
yeah.
But even despite all of that, the opportunity, the invitation to play that rock climbing has become for me is something that feels really essential.
Yeah.
You know, like that feeling I get when I do one move that I didn't think that I could do, you know, or like I see a video of my body swinging around and I'm like, that was fun. And I did do that. Like,
yeah,
it's really, it allows me to move with confidence in other parts of my life where there's uncertainty.
Yeah.
And also it helps me remember like, none of this is that serious.
Right.
You know, like we're just electricity through meat on a rock spinning in the void. Like
that's it. There, that's the one.
Yeah. Like if you want to go play rocks and the game of rocks, like the way that people usually play it is like, oh my gosh, you can do that. Great. Can you get up that rock a harder way now? Like what a silly game. Why is the game? Can we do this a harder way? You know?
Yeah.
And my partner Lou is really like such a helpful person with all that, just the way that they approach rock climbing. And, you know, through all that, I've gotten to be a part of a community that's like, I mostly climb with like women and queer people and disabled people. And honestly, highly recommend. If you want to hang out with like a bunch of encouraging people and all just like have a nice time trying, like I recommend finding a rock climbing group that's like centered around one of those, you know, identities. Even, you know, the disabled climbers that I climb with, you know, it's helpful to have an able-bodied volunteer. And like, they're all better than me, you know, like, and they're all having fun playing the game rocks.
I love the way you spoke about how that community is sort of, not to jump into agility too much, but it's agile to the different levels of accessibility because there's disabled people in the group.
Absolutely.
So bringing in able-bodied people to help support and create access for the less abled is amazing. And I think that that is another aspect of being in community and in self-directed education communities that's really important.
Absolutely. And also to bring it back to Agile. So one of the things that I got to do is I got to facilitate rock climbing for a lot of the 7 years I was there. Obviously, you know, there was a pandemic and lockdown for in the middle of that. So we did not go rock climbing during those times. But you know, thinking about nervous systems and like the things that we can learn when we like learn to manage our nervous system when we're rock climbing, right? Like that's part of the finding, part of why I bring up the PTSD is like, it's been very helpful for me as a container, right? To be like, yes, you're very scared, right? But you're not actually in danger.
Right?
You're safe. Like your body thinks that you're in danger, but that's okay. You can tell your nervous system, like, I'm not in danger right now.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of kids who have this experience, you know, like they're obviously kids with PTSD, but like things like PDA autism, you know, like there's lots of reasons why a kid's nervous system might be overreactive to their environment. Right. And getting to go rock climbing. I had a kid this year, like, you know, on the spectrum, around 10 years old, we went rock climbing, you know, consistently, like was really dedicated from the beginning. And, you know, she would get like 3 feet off the ground and be like, I'm so scared, I'm gonna fall. And I'd be like, you're safe, it's okay. Let's take a deep breath. Like, it's just your body. It's just your brain overreacting. Your body is safe. Like, let's climb back down. Do you want to jump? You know, like we did weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks of this. And then we were having a visiting week. The way that admissions works at ALC is, at Alknik at least, is that we would have the kids visit for a whole week to decide if they were a good fit for us and if we were a good fit for them and their family.
Okay.
And so we've got two kids visiting. They're 4 and 6 years old. And we're all going to the park. This rock climber gets in the elevator with the two visiting kids and a 13-year-old. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll meet you downstairs. And, you know, it's only 2 floors. I usually take the stairs. I walk downstairs. I'm waiting outside the elevator and the elevator is not opening. And then suddenly I hear screaming from inside the wall.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, oh God, what's happened? You know, like I'm calling to them. Hey guys, finally, like I hear a, like, okay, hey, everybody, shh. And like somebody in the elevator, like calming them all down. And we start communicating. I call the super calls the elevator company. The elevator company says that they called from inside the elevator already and somebody's on their way. You know, these kids are like trapped in the elevator between the floors.
No.
And it was a saga, you know, 30 minutes. It turns out they jumped in the elevator. Never jump in the elevator. This is why. The elevator thinks you're free falling and it will stop, you know? But anyway, 35 minutes later, everybody is out of the elevator and safe, you know, like everyone was just scared, but not, you know, it could have been a dangerous situation, right?
Right.
These are just kids who are in this elevator. There's no facilitator in there to calm everybody down. But when they came out, the kid who had been rock climbing with me, the 10-year-old, was like, I remembered what you said when we went rock climbing about how it doesn't help to panic and how we have to like breathe and help our bodies calm down so we can think.
Oh, I love that.
And I was like, ah, knock me over, you know?
Yeah. So your role was third facilitator. How many facilitators total at Alknik?
Our enrollment varied. We had between 20, actually at one point we were down to like 15 to like 35 kids. So we had between 2 and 4 full-time facilitators and various like volunteers, support staff, people coming in.
Okay. So you're one of, you know, a handful of facilitators, and
yeah,
we've had one guest speak about Agile learning centers a bit, but more as someone who's interned at several different types of centers. So you're really the first person to speak and be like a representative of the model in some capacity. So I think first, maybe we should start with, what does Agile mean in this sense? For any listeners who might be completely new to this model, like, where did this framework come from? What does this mean?
Sure. Well, Agile Learning Centers, actually, Alknik is the flagship and the original. So the origin story is that there was a free school, and that free school closed for financial reasons, where ALC is now. And Thomas Parker, who's down at ALC Mosaic, and Ryan, who are childhood friends, were involved at MFS, Manhattan Free School. And when it closed, some of the parents were like, hey, we really want you to like make a school so our kid can still go here, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And those parents were involved in software development. And Ruben Dario from, I guess he's associated with the ALC down in Jalapa, although he works on a billion amazing projects, he came up and got involved. And so the three of them wound up stealing some of the Agile software management tools in order to basically make a structure for a self-directed school, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea behind the structure is that they want to have maximum support with minimum interference. This has basically boiled down to a set of meetings and a grab bag of tools, as well as like a couple of statements of purpose. But I really want to be careful speaking to about all of the ALCs, because every ALC does it differently.
Right.
The thing that I think is really great about the ALC network is that, you know, while these tools were developed specifically to serve, you know, this community in East Harlem, where there were like parents who worked in tech and like, you know, neurodivergent kids who like visualization tools and, you know, figuring out how they're going to spend their time in New York City. You know, and those guys did a great job of finding and bringing in people who really had the vision, right? Like Abby Olton got involved early on that first year. They're the first person, you know, she's the first person they brought on, and she really like dug into a lot of this. Mercer Carlin was one of those parents who was like, hey, my kid needs a school. I just mentioned these names because these folks are still involved in the ALC network, right? And making stuff happen on the network level. And Thomas and his now partner, Nancy, who also showed up in the first year and is one of the directors at ALC Mosaic, I believe, that basically, the tools are important, but the tools are not the most important thing. The most is like this structure of trust and the iterative process. So what I mean by the iterative process, that's really the thing that was stolen from this Agile software, borrowed from, I don't feel bad stealing things from corporations, but borrowed is a better word because there's enough of it to go around. But basically, like, anything you try, you can try again or do something else. All of the meetings are designed to be, okay, we made this decision now, we're going to check in on this when we have this meeting again next week. You know, like, we're going to set the week, you know, we're going to sit down on Monday and we're going to plan what we're doing for this next week, you know, but nothing is... nothing about the structure is sacred.
So basically you can take or leave parts of it in your specific
structure,
or change
because,
it and call it something.
Exactly. Different. And like changing things up is really important.
Yeah.
You know, so the tools, the like meeting tools that we use, there's three fundamental meetings. One of them is called Set the Week. It's on Monday morning. Everybody gets together and sits down in a room and we figure out what's going to be on the schedule for the week. And in that meeting, you could use a variety of different tools, right, that we talk about in like all the Agile facilitator guide and like things like that. Mm-hmm. Basically, this is a grassroots network. You pay the membership fee, which I believe is $95, and you can download all the tools and join the Slack and like see the conversation that people are having about how they run their various set the weeks, right?
Right.
So we have a tool that's called a game shifting board that like, you know, has options and magnets on it. And it's a visual aid that says like, how are we talking right now, right? Are we raising our hands? Are we going turns in a circle? Are we babbling with our neighbors? You know, are we using a facilitator stick? When will the meeting end, right? Will it end when we're done? Will it end on time? What is that time, right? So there's like a visual tool that you can use.
Right.
But you can customize that tool to whoever you're going to have in front of you, right? If you've got a bunch of kids who are pre-literate, you probably don't want a ton of writing on that tool, right? You right. want drawings, you know?
Right.
And so we do set the week the way, you know, it's changed over the years, the way that we did it. But basically, you know, it's a meeting that takes maybe up to half an hour sometimes only 10 minutes where we set the week for that week. Now, I know another ALC out in Oklahoma where they do set the block. And so they set 6 weeks at a time.
Oh.
Because they decided that that's what worked better for their community.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually.
Yeah, like they were doing this weekly meeting every week. Yeah, Amber out there is a friend, and we had weekly phone calls for many, many years where we talked about what we were doing at our various ALCs. And like, that's just what worked for them.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to know that they'd be able to have 6 weeks of working on this book project and then the schedule would change, you know?
Yeah.
And so they just made that change for their community. So that's one of the meetings. The second meeting is called, well, we call it Spawn. because again, video, like
gamers,
computer people culture. Exactly. So for those who don't know, your spawn point is the place where you appear in a video game. So we do morning spawn and afternoon spawn. Other ALCs call it different things. This is the most controversially named meeting, and I get it as a non-gamer myself. And in the morning, basically everybody says, what are you going to do today? And in the afternoon, you reflect, what did I actually do today?
Mm.
And there's a bunch of different tools we use for that meeting. I really like a Kanban board, which is, again, used in a lot of software development practices. There's a book called Personal Kanban that's quite good. And it involves like using sticky notes to create a to-do list that's a pull system instead of a push system. And I could talk about this endlessly, and I won't because it's so boring to other people, but you know, if anyone wants to DM me on Instagram and talk about personal Kanban, you know, please do. But also, like, you could write a list in a notebook, you could keep a list on your phone, you could use a tool called Trello, which is basically a digital Kanban that we like to use because it makes it easy to like export and make transcripts of mm-hmm. people's intentions.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like I'm saying, multiplicity of tools. You know, I've had kids make a bunch of flashcards with pictures on them. I had a student who was 5 and from Switzerland, and so didn't speak much English. So we made these flashcards that like had drawings and the like English and Swissdeutsch like words of what the things were that they like to do during the day. And that mm-hmm. was a really great tool for that 6-year-old.
Yeah.
And then the third and final meeting that's like essential, that I would say is essential to the Agile model, is called, it's actually two meetings called Check-In and Change-Up. Now at Alknic, we split these up into a mandatory and a non-mandatory meeting. The mandatory meeting is check-in, where we talk about any awarenesses that we have from the week. So an awareness could be, there's a lot of mud getting tracked through the school.
Right.
Because people are walking inside with their shoes on. And that's it. That's just the awareness. The whole meeting is like, okay, thanks, Mel. All right, what's our next awareness? people are putting trash in the recycling. Okay, great. Thanks, you know, kid who runs the sustainability support group, you know, like, what's the next awareness, you know? And then we just go through all the awarenesses and we make an agenda by putting all these stickies up on the board. And then we say, okay, that's it for change up, for check-in. If anyone wants to stay for change up and make any decisions about any of the awarenesses that we have, you know, that's the meeting that we're going to do now. And however many kids want to stay, we'll stay. And a thing that we always tell them is decisions are made by people who show up, right?
Yeah.
Which is why we don't make this meeting mandatory.
Right.
But everyone has agreed to abide by the decisions made by the people in this meeting.
Right.
And everybody has the power to stay and talk about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so then, like, in the muddy shoes example, we might make an agreement then that's like, okay, everyone will either take off their shoes and on the lobby carpet or wear shoe covers. And how are we going to make the shoe covers? Oh, okay, you're going to make some? Perfect. You know, we'll check in on that in a week. Maybe we come back in a week and actually the shoe covers didn't get made. They're harder to sew than I thought. Okay, should we look into buying some? Should we just ask everybody to take off their shoes? Should we tell people to bring in slippers? Like, you know, then we check in the next week. Okay, well, some people brought in slippers. And we got some paper covers for shoes, but actually we're going through them kind of fast and we're worried about the waste. What if we ordered some reusable shoe covers? Okay, we actually really like this. We're going to keep doing it.
Yeah.
And so we use a tool called a community mastery board that's got a bunch of different columns on it. It's a kind of Kanban board. So things go from a testing agreement, right? We're going to test every new rule that we start. And we call all of our rules agreements because we're all agreeing to do it just the same, you know, me as right. the facilitator, as well as the kids. Okay, if the agreement is take off your shoes when you come in the lobby carpet or wear slippers, we're testing that agreement 1 week. Okay, maybe we'll swap that out. And the next week we're testing take off your shoes on the lobby carpet or wear shoe covers. And once we have 6 weeks, 6 months go by, everybody's taken off their shoes, nobody's even thinking about it. Then we can take that practicing agreement and we can put it into mastered. That's something that we've mastered, you know?
Yeah.
And it really gives the kids a sense of ownership over the space, right? The yeah. rules are made by the people who show up at these meetings. And also it gives them a sense of mastery. Even if you're not there making that decision, every day that you come into the lobby and you take off your shoes, you're helping us as a community get better at mastering the things that we're trying to do. And like, that's a really empowering feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what I would say about the ALC model. It's kind of been a long answer, but, you know, it's hard. The answer is always, it depends, right, when it comes to ALC. And so what an ALC looks like depends on where that ALC is and what the needs of that group are. For us in New York, those three meetings were the most important things, the tools that we used in them. And we had a really, you know, large spectrum of children at ALCNIC. So I'm pretty confident that, you know, there's a lot of different folks that those meetings work for, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you gave such a good explanation that as you were explaining it, I was like visualizing it as a flow chart.
Yes. Like, it's really similar.
Yes. Everything you do can just like bump up against trial and error, and then you can just try something else.
Yeah.
I also really, really love that this highlights the community responsibility,
mm-hmm.
the community commitment to what happens, whether we make ourselves aware of it, you know, in an awareness meeting or not. Like, we're going to see it all. And I think it limits the interference of adults being like, oh no, we shouldn't do it that way, because if we do it that way, then this happens. And then when this happens, then we're going to end up here and then we'll spend more money. And so why don't we just do this instead? When that might be the right answer, but it wasn't the path that these young people needed to take to get there to understand why that was the right answer.
Absolutely. I actually have a story that's my favorite story. That's a really good example of this from Jean Finley, actually in Philly, where the kids organized in Change Up to eliminate all the meetings. They were like, wait, so if we're in charge, can we just get rid of all the meetings? Like, we don't have to do it. If we all agree we're going to practice no meetings, then like, we'll do it, right? Like, we can do that. And big massive credit to Jean and all the other facilitators at ALC Philly. They're like, I mean, you're right, you know, like that is true. And so there were like a solid 3 weeks where there were no meetings. And the facilitators are like reassuring parents who are like, what is going on at this school? Like, it's going to be okay. You got to trust the process. And eventually the kids decided, actually, this is really confusing. We don't know what we've been doing. We don't know when stuff is happening. We keep missing on stuff we want to do because it's so disorganized. Yeah. And they reinstated all the meetings.
Yeah, like they just needed to come to that in their own mind, right? They need to understand the purpose.
Yep.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we always, that we do every year that I highly recommend to new ALCs when they're getting started is that we remove all of the agreements that we've made for the start of the new school year.
Oh, this is
nothing
really
carries
interesting.
Over.
This is yes. So interesting.
Yes.
Okay. I love this because I think that when you do have stuff that carries over, it doesn't make sense to the new people, right?
Exactly.
Like they don't understand the origin of that rule.
Exactly.
I did some time working in Sudbury, and that was one of the biggest things that I found with people who were entirely new to Sudbury, but also just new to self-direction in general. They, like, the law book was like, what?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah. Part of the reason that we do it this way is because of that exact thing. Like, we saw it at free schools, you know, there's, like, it gets very litigious.
Yeah.
And children can be litigious. I just want to say, like, small lawyers, all of them. And so, you know, we really want to encourage the kids to think about the, like, spirit of why we're asking for things.
Right.
And so, which is not to say, like, we have a student agreement. And all of the other agreements are expanding on that, basically.
Yeah.
So, and the student agreement, it's very simple. Every kid signs it. The facilitators sign it. You know, parents all get to see it. Like, and I think most ALCs have slightly different language on it, but I'm sure, like, it's a binding contract, you know? And it's like, you agree to be kind and respectful to yourself and others. You agree to participate in meetings. You agree to abide by community-created agreements. You will clean up after yourself, respect the space and shared materials, and you'll share your learning. And that's it.
So if any of these are not upheld, is this something that's brought up at awareness time?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you could say, so we talk about the awarenesses in relationship to the enrollment agreement, right?
Okay.
The recycling thing is about respecting the space, right? And like one that comes up every year because we have teenagers is cursing, right? Obviously. Mm-hmm. And so every single year that I worked at ALC, without fail, we had a discussion about cursing at Change Up and made the agreement, don't curse at others. Because cursing in and of itself, neutral, right? Learning how to do it well is something I want kids to learn how to do. They grew up in New York, we're dropping F-bombs everywhere. You know, like, I know my city. But also, saying F you is not respectful,
right?
If I stub my toe and I'm like, ah, fuck, you know, like, that's one thing. And it's different than saying F you. And so we have this discussion every year where I'm like, listen, this is New York City. I don't want you to practice saying F you to your friend because it's disrespectful. I don't care whether your friend thinks it's respectful or not. Like, what I care about is you getting in the habit of turning around and saying F you to someone when they bump into you. Because if you do that on the subway platform to the wrong stranger, that's actually extremely dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't want you to navigate the world that way. And that's why we have to be, that's why we have to practice being respectful to each other here. Because what we practice here is what we will do in the world when we are under stress and not thinking.
Yes, the nuance of situational appropriateness.
Yes.
And yeah, like Yeah, just situational appropriateness, I think is it totally sums that up. Like it happens in an honest conversation like that, where someone who maybe has more information than you do about how that could affect you goes, "Hey, talk about that."
This is actually a hazard that you're not considering, and like it's my job. For one summer, I worked as a play worker at a junkyard playground. There's one on Governor's Island in New York City. And we talked a lot during that about the difference between risk and hazard. And this is something I think about a lot as a rock climber as well. But basically, risks are known dangers, right? You can choose to take a risk, but hazards are unknown unknowns. And so, like, kids who like hazards can become risks when you know about them, right? So, in the example of cursing, like that hazard of like, oh, cursing at a stranger could put me in danger becomes a risk when you articulate it to the kid in the in that situation. You know, and sometimes hazards can never be accounted for, right? Like, you know, when people talk about complex environments and rock climbing, like, you know, sometimes you're out there and like a chunk of rock the size of a refrigerator just falls off the side of the mountain, you know? Life is inherently dangerous. But learning how to engage with risk involves being able to name what the actual danger is. And I always try and stick to like, if this kid is not going to care about this example that I give them, then why am I telling them, you know?
Oh yeah, you definitely I think there's also nuance around that too, is like how to communicate it in a way that you are going to be received, because again, it's back to relationship and the kind of relationship you're in with these young people.
Absolutely.
And I think when there is a foundation of trust and, like, for lack of better words, and I'll probably show my age here by using the word cool, but like if you are like cool enough because you've passed the trust, bar basically for young people, they're more apt to listening to what you have to say.
Absolutely. And when you've shown you're genuinely curious about what they're doing and why they're doing it, I think that young people are really good at sussing out the difference between someone who's asking, like, what are you doing so that they can correct you, and someone who's asking, what are you doing so that you can give them a long explanation of what it is that you're doing. And, you know, that can be applied to things like quote unquote bad behavior, right?
Say more about that.
Since, like, I don't know, thinking about cursing, like, I'm thinking of two gamers I had, right? And they were like really swearing at their computers, you know, obviously playing a game together one morning. And I came in and I was like, hey, like, what's going on? And it turns out that they were like, they had encountered a troll, right, online who was saying all this homophobic stuff. And they were genuine, they were really upset, you know? And they're like trying to kill this troll in the game, and they're both swearing. And I was like, hey. So actually, like, did you guys know that the best way to get rid of a troll is to starve them? You can't actually like explode them. It just like gives them more and more power. And they were like, what do you mean? And so we like had a whole conversation about like nodding, don't feed the trolls, basically. Which is a thing that like I want young people to feel empowered to do online. You know, like if you encounter a troll, you can block them, you can report them, but the best thing to do is to just get out of there. Like, don't give them any of your energy because that's the thing that they want, right? And because I went in with genuine curiosity, like, oh, are you guys upset? Like, what's going on? Like, what's happening in your game? Instead of like, oh my God, you guys are swearing so much. Like, do you know, like coming in with an energy that's like ostensibly asking why this is happening, but actually is doing it in order to make a correction. You know, like I think that they really, I got to have a really good conversation. They were like, but you're gay, you know, like, aren't you upset? I was like, of course I'm upset. You know, like, I don't like it when people talk like this online, but that doesn't mean that doing this is going to make it stop, you know?
Yeah. And then it's like, yeah, there's a whole other conversation that can go from there into like how it makes you feel and like all of that energy that you carry from that interaction, and future interactions for the rest of the day. And yeah, all of that.
Yeah. But starting with genuine curiosity about like, what are you doing? You know, led by a groundwork of many months of coming in and being like, hey, what game are you playing? You know, like,
right.
I'm not a gamer, like I mentioned, but you know, like I'm down to sit. I spent a lot of my childhood. I got a little brother, you know, like I used to date boys, you know, like I've watched a lot of people play video games in my life.
Yeah.
And it's kind of fun, you know, like there's something about, you know, I'm not a Minecrafter, but like I love to have a kid show me what they built in Minecraft, you know, like top favorite things is to get an explainer of what's happening in here. And, you know,
craft tours are like top tier, invitations from children.
they really are. And, you know I'm not a parent, like I'm coming at all of this as not a parent. So I don't share people's screen anxieties in the same way as people who are parents do, you know, which yeah. I want to acknowledge, like, I don't have a kid who's my kid who I'm like, am I screwing you up? You know?
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for the like level of pressure that parents put on themselves to make good decisions about unknown unknowns, right? And like everything about the internet, about how we interact with technology is unknown unknowns for kids, but it is for us too.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think that approaching technology with curiosity, not fear, has been one of the things I've really been able to offer kids as a facilitator. And what I've seen over the years of doing that is that the more curiosity I have about their digital worlds, the more excited they are to engage with me in like the meat space, as we used to call it.
You know? For sure. I think you're so right. And yeah, I think parents definitely grapple with a very delicate dance around that. Digital stuff is really difficult, but once you see the kind of spaces that these young people make for themselves online, and they invite you in, and you can see what they're spending their time doing and thinking about and building and learning about, like coming to you with these, you know, gemstones and types of metals and building materials that you didn't know they would ever know about. Like, it may seem so silly, but that is like a top tier invitation. So yeah, shout out to all the parents grappling with that. It is a lot of work. Only each family community can figure out how to do that, right? There can't be this like dogmatic application of a rule that's like never any rules or all the rules. Like, it's so much more nuanced than that. Partnership is much stickier than just it's this or that. It's black or white.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
and like, you know, with screen time stuff, like we always had held the position that was like, we're not going to police what your kids do. But we will reflect any agreements that you have with your kid when we see them breaking it, right? Yeah. And then they can make a choice about that.
Okay, so that's very different in that some self-directed spaces, there aren't parent-child agreements that are upheld in the SDE space. They're separated. So that's an interesting way that you partner with parents as well, it seems.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a delicate dance because over the years, like the two things that we would see agreements about most often, one is screen time and the other is going to math, right? and in both cases, we say the same thing, which is, you know, happy to reflect any agreements that you have with your kid that we know about. So, you know, if I see a kid playing Roblox when they said they were going to go to math, right? And math is happening now. I'll go over to that kid and be like, hey, do you know math is happening now? Like, I know you had some agreements with your grownups about that. And they'll be like, you know, they have choices in that, right? Because that's just a neutral statement.
Right. It's still their choice.
Yeah. Did you know math is happening now? I'm aware that you have this agreement with your parents, you know?
Right.
And then from there, the kid gets to decide, am I going to keep the agreement with my parents? Am I going to interpret it a different way and go to maths in half an hour? Am I going to ask for MELF with help doing that? You know, hey, can you set a timer and come back in 20 minutes? You know, sure. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But in all of those choice points is where the learning is happening. So even on the days where you're like, I'm going to choose to break my agreement, I'm like, okay, but I'm not going to lie to your parents for you. You know, if they ask me, I'm going to tell them the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to be free to make quote unquote mistakes, like,
yes.
In order to do any learning, you have to. And I think part of the trouble with schooling conventionally is that it really discourages making mistakes. You know, if you get a question wrong, you could fail instead of being like, oh, that was a really interesting way you got that question wrong. And like, how did you interpret it? And like, oh, I see where you're coming from. Or like, oh, I see this fundamental mistake. And like, did you realize this thing about, you know, like,
right.
There's no opportunity to engage with the mistake. And so no learning gets to come out of it.
Yeah. But yeah, you just learn internalized shame.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know you mentioned that ALCs are different.
Yes.
But I wonder what kind of options are available for young people throughout the day. You talked about how you can, you know, reiterate any agreements that they might have with their folks, but the sticky notes are all on the board and people have choices, right? For set the day. And
yeah. So for set the week, do you want me to talk about like what kinds of offerings we might have during the week at ALCDEC?
Yeah, you could if you want. Or just what does your particular community usually throw on that board? I'm curious.
Okay. Sure. We used to one thing that we did for most of the regular years that we ran school, so excluding, you know, our pandemic years. Where we actually did more of this, but we did a lot of field trips. You know, we live in New York City. You can take any number of kids on a field trip, right? Because everyone's either walking or taking public transportation. So we didn't have to worry about like cars.
Mm-hmm.
And so like once a week we would go to the Met or the Museum of Natural History or, you know, or Central Park or a bookstore or, you know, the public library. Like you could go on a field trip every week in New York City and never see the same thing twice if you wanted, you know? And then the rest of the offerings, it's a mix between like, I'm trying to think of percentages, but it's really hard to like divide it up. It just depends on the point in time, but it's a mix between facilitators coming in and saying, hey, I'm really interested in this thing. And I think that you guys would really like it too, right? So that's things like rock climbing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where I would like talk to kids and be like, yeah. Like if you want to go rock climbing, we could put it on the schedule. Like, let me email this gym, let me whatever, you know? Or it could be something like, oh, one offering I made this year was called Pecha Kucha, which is a game. It's like a slideshow game that I had played at this art camp for grownups that I went to called School of the Alternative, which is a wonderful organization. And like, you know, you made 20 slides and then you have to explain the whole thing in 2 minutes. And like, that was just like, I was like, oh yeah, I remembered this game and I think it would be fun. You know, like young people often schedule things like werewolves or Roblox time or, you know, D&D has been a staple for years because, you know, 5 years ago, a kid came to me who was like, had spent the previous year being like, I'm not interested in anything. I don't want to go to the park. I don't want to play that game. I'm sick of this, you know, came in the following September and was like, I discovered D&D. Can we play? And I was like, I guess, you know? And so I rapidly learned how to DM a D&D game, you know?
Yeah.
And then we usually have a couple academic-y offerings on the schedule. Ryan offered math the entire 7 years that I was at ALC. At least once a week, usually twice. And he genuinely just like enjoys it, you know? He started out being like, There was a parent who was also volunteering to run math. And she had like a background in like, you know, high level mathematics, basically. Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh, cool. I'm going to go to this because like, I'm interested in stats because I want to be better at fantasy baseball. And then, you know, that parent eventually stopped volunteering, you know, like her schedule changed, her life changed, but like Ryan just kept going, you know?
Nice.
And he's like, yeah, I used to hate math, but now I'm like pretty good at it.
Wow.
And yeah, it was always interesting to see how that shook out, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like who went just because they had to and who started going because their friend was going and like, you know, who just showed up and was like, oh, yes, finally someone to talk about math with, you know? Like,
yeah.
And you get all the whole range of feelings about it, you know, like people really hone in on math because people have a lot of feelings about how they were forced to learn math in school.
Right.
But if you don't present it in that same, like, you know, broccoli is gross package.
Right, right.
Then kids have different feelings about it, especially when they realize they're like already doing math. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I also think there's something to be said about, I think what I was trying to get a feel for when I was asking about what types of things might be available.
Yeah.
It's like a variety, having a variety of offerings, yes, and things, yes, that are accessible, that are, visible.
Yes.
I find like, I used to use like language that felt very like merchandisey, capitalist, because retail in my early years, but
sure.
I have since transitioned to understand that it's not really that things need to be marketed in your space, like having forward-facing books. It's not marketing. It's object permanence. It's the idea of people getting to actually see and have access to the things that are available to them versus them being tucked away. And
absolutely.
So that can happen with like your physical stuff, but also this board, like,
yes,
having a visual representation of all of what is available to you, I'm sure opens up the minds of certain types of people, myself
definitely
included. If I can
definitely
see it visually, it changes the way I might be inclined to try something different or new.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Totally,
yeah,
agree. Yeah. We call the, I think it's from autism, like accommodations, the word strewing. Have you heard this?
Yes. Unschoolers, yeah, do that quite a lot.
Yeah. So like, it's like strewing, like both the physical stuff that you're talking about, right? Like sometimes I'll go into the makerspace and like take out some new material and just start working with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But also in the sense of like, yeah, reminders, visual reminders and writing and text. I mean, there's whiteboards everywhere in the space of just like, what's happening, you know? Like, what could you be doing right now?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You could be going to the park. You could be doing math. You could be learning grammar. You could be going to history. You could be playing werewolves, you know?
So
you
many
could
possibilities.
Be Minecrafting, yeah, with friends. Exactly.
Yeah.
And just opening, yeah, this language of like you could or you can. I really tried in the last year I was there. I got into a thing where I tried to start as many sentences. Like if a kid asked me a question, I would try and start my response with you can. Even if it was something that I didn't want, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, like my goal as a facilitator was always to help the kids feel as like safe and empowered to make choices as they could.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of reasons why kids don't feel safe or why they don't feel like a choice is a genuine choice, you know?
Right.
And like in a setting like ALC, where we were a private school, right? That's the only way in the state of New York where we're at that you can not do the Common Core state curriculum and you can opt out of state testing, right? Mm-hmm. You can always opt into doing those things. But we had the ultimate freedom to be like, hey, if you don't like this, like, that's totally cool. You don't have to go to school here, you know?
Yeah.
You can go to school wherever you want. You can go to school at a place that feels good to you. And, you know, have had kids leave for a variety of reasons. It's New York City, so it's a very transient city, you know. Every single friend I made in that rock climbing group 7 years ago no longer lives in New York, including me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the ultimate choice is like whether or not you want to engage with this community to begin with, you know, not in an exclusionary way.
Would that be a reason people would leave, is not wanting to engage in this particular type of structure?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes. I mean, you know, sometimes it was like, I want to go to a conventional high school because I want there to be more people around and I want to be in a musical, you know?
Right, right.
Which is like super valid. Can't provide you with any of those things, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes it would be like, I don't want to make these choices, you know? Like, I do kind of want someone to tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's valid. You know, I think that that even those kids, even kids who are with us for a year and we're like, I don't want to get involved, you know, I don't want to go to change up. I don't want to make decisions, whatever. Like, I just want to go to a regular school and have it be regular. Like, at least they know, you know, going forward that places like this exist, places that give them these kind of choices, and that they are the kind of person who has autonomy. That they could go there and then also leave.
Yeah.
You know, what, is it hard to watch those kids leave sometimes? Yeah.
Probably.
You know? And like, for me, like, I never got to go to a school like this. I'm like, oh my God, why would you go to a regular school if you could go to this, you know?
But, yeah. Yeah. But everybody's got a different perspective, different life experience, different desires.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's funny. A musical really can drive someone to leave their, I'm using freedom in air quotes because it may not be entirely leaving it behind, but you know, leave their freedom behind and go to conventional school just so they can be in a musical or just so they can play on a softball team or
yeah,
just so they can go on a senior trip, you know, yeah. Or a prom or whatever the case is.
Right.
Yeah.
And I heard from a couple of, we had like a group of these kids who wound up leaving like during COVID time, basically, who are now like juniors and seniors in high school. And we heard from a couple of them recently and they're all thriving, you know, and they're all like, actually, I really credit ALC with like helping me get to know myself. Like I'm having a way better time than I would have if I hadn't gone there.
Yeah.
And like, you don't have to do something forever for it to have been worthwhile and meaningful.
Totally. Something can come into your life just for a brief time.
Yeah. And still be really impactful.
Yeah. Very much. Very much. And I think in the reverse, sometimes I think there are young people who have been raised this way for so long that they may not realize what other options might be out there. They might be stuck. And so sometimes maybe going to a space like this could help because maybe they're, you know, unschooling or doing self-directed education in a smaller community, in a co-op or just at home.
Yeah. And
being in a space like this might give them a visual, right, of more opportunities, of more things they could get involved in. Change up the group of people they're spending their time around, get some different influence from some different adults who want meaningful connection to self-directed youth. So
absolutely. Yeah. And like, I think that the thing that you're talking about, that like connection with a variety of people having a variety of interests and perspectives, is one of the most valuable things that we can offer, that any self-directed space can offer, you know?
For sure.
Because like the kids bring so much of what happens in the space, you know, I want to say it's like 60% them and 40% grownups, you know, but I want it to be higher than that. I want it to be 75% kids. I want it to be 90% kids, you know, and like, I would like, it changes over time, right? Like how much they're holding versus how much the grownups are holding. But in a healthy community, you know, they're holding a lot of it, and they're bringing in their own interests, and that's spreading throughout each other. They're inventing games together, you know? Yeah. And they're meeting people who are both similar and different to them, right? And having to find ways to play with each other across those spectrums. And like, sometimes the people that you have the most trouble with are not the people who are the most different from you. They're the ones who are like you, right?
Yeah.
And that are, that like bring up the stuff that you struggle with about yourself. You know, yeah. I remember being in a conflict mediation where what a teenager described these two fighting preteens as the same person in different fonts. and everyone was really like, that is what's happening here, though.
Different fonts. That reminds me of my young people have, this is totally off topic, but it's just related to what you said.
Yeah.
My young people have told me that there is a type of singing that's called singing in cursive. Have you heard of this?
Oh my God. Yep. Singing in cursive. Yeah. That's where you like slide all your letters together. Yeah.
I'm like, this is wild. I did not realize that there was a name for this. And they were like, how could you not know? It's singing in cursive. Like, well, forgive me. I didn't catch the memo.
Oh, I love that. That's so good.
So one last piece. We're kind of coming up on time, but this is kind of a really important one. So I wanted to cover
it. Absolutely.
It's kind of more related to accessibility and the intersectional lens on humanity and our history. But specifically in self-directed education, I think there's this piece that people can get really wound tight around mm-hmm. with coercion. Mm. And I would agree that, or I would argue that it often lacks a lot of nuance, like the things that we've said before, like it's a very black and white issue. And so it leads a lot of adults to say, like, the greater issues that society is grappling with or facing should not be brought into the learning spaces, because that is, you know, both an adult idea and therefore can be coercive. And, you know, some will even go to the extreme and argue that it's indoctrinating youth to, you know, have their specific adult belief or way about things.
Sure.
But intersectionality literally cannot allow me to ignore the very real lived experiences of marginalized people and the context in which we live. And so
absolutely,
I think these things can't be ignored in spaces. And I wonder if you might speak to how that might show up in your space.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And anything else you want to say about that?
Sure. I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's, something I hear about, but don't really, I really disagree, you know? First of all, I don't think there's, like, unless we're talking about, like, explicit sex, you know, like, I think there are very few things that are adult only.
Right.
And when it comes to conversations about, you know, intersectionality, how folks occupying marginalized identities move through the world, you know, when it comes to all the isms, like pretending like children live in this like saturan world of, you know, cotton candy clouds and unknowingness is, I think, a little ignorant on the part of grownups.
Mm-hmm.
I think it comes from especially a lot of white grownups, you know, who have the privilege of not having to think about their own race, right, or their own gender from a young age. And like, that's great for you if that was your experience, you know, like, no shade. But I'm working with Black and white and brown and all kinds of children from New York City, you know, like, and I have to talk to my 13-year-olds about how to ride the train safely, you know, because stop and frisk is starting to be a thing again in New York City. And so if I'm actually not talking to them about the existence of racism and policing, I am doing them a disservice. They will be less safe in the world. And like, you know, on a less extreme part of the spectrum, I guess, like, I'm a trans person. My pronouns are they and he. They're from when I started at ALC, there were trans kids as a part of the community. And so we always have had you know, we always introduce ourselves with our name and our pronouns. And I, you know, you can explain to a six-year-old what your pronouns are, if they're what you want other people to call you when they're not using your name. So, you know, sometimes people have strong feelings about them. Sometimes they feel like they're a boy and they want to be called he and him. And sometimes they feel like they're a girl and they want to be called she or her. And sometimes they feel different than that and they want to be called something different, you know?
Right.
If boy is like being chocolate and being a girl is like being vanilla, then I'm strawberry flavored. Mm. And like saying that to a six-year-old in a developmentally appropriate way, right? Like, here's a metaphor about ice cream.
Right.
That takes less than a minute to say and helps them. It gives them a rung of understanding so that they can keep like climbing this ladder of learning that they're on. I think that that only helps a child.
Yeah.
Because things that you don't know about are automatically hazards. They're automatically unknown unknowns and automatically dangerous.
Right.
If you're in a learning space, then there shouldn't, I don't think that there should be limits on what you can talk about.
Because right. I think if a young person has the capacity to bring something up that they saw on a TikTok, that they saw their parents yes. watching on the news, that they saw yes. on the newsstand,
Absolutely, then
they're capable of understanding some sort of response.
Yes. If they're bringing it up, you owe them an honest answer.
Yes.
Because if you don't give them an honest answer, they're going to go find an answer somewhere else. And you don't know where that something somewhere else is going to be or what that or how true that answer is going to be.
Right.
You know, like think about it that way. Like if they come to you and they're like, you know, what's trans? Like if you can give them a developmentally appropriate 1 minute answer, that will, they'll be like, okay, great, you know, and they'll go on with their day. But if you make a big deal about it by being like, oh, that's not really for you to know about, like, don't worry about it, like, that doesn't apply to you, then right. like, suddenly it becomes this whole big, weird mystery. Why can't I know about it? What if it does apply to me? Like, is right. it a disease? Can I catch it? You know, like, it starts to create all this anxiety that could easily be dispelled by a little bit of information.
Yeah.
And I think it is the absolute responsibility of all adults in self-directed spaces to be continuously learning. Yeah. And to be continuously learning about the parts of ourselves that we're not maybe the most excited about. You know, like mm-hmm. doing anti-racism work as a white person doesn't always feel good, right? But it is absolutely necessary for me to responsibly be an educator who is a white person who works with Black children in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, hands down, if I don't do that work, then I am going to harm those children. And if you don't feel like you could speak with nuance on these topics, then, you know, it's time to get learning. Like, self-directed education is not just for children, right?
Yeah.
Like, I started this by saying, like, you know, all these things I learned through the process of being a facilitator,
yeah.
you know, like it's always been really important to me that I call myself a facilitator and not a teacher, because I'm not always in the position of the one doing the teaching.
Yeah. Sometimes you're receiving it, right?
Exactly. Like, a facilitator is just someone who makes something easier, right?
Yeah.
I'm there to make, I'm there to do it alongside you.
Yeah.
You know, and if that means sometimes I have to go off and do my own deep learning in order to be able to be there alongside you, right? Then I'm going to do that because I want to be responsible in not indoctrinating children into white supremacy culture, which is what we're going to do if we don't go about this thoughtfully, right? Because that's the other piece. Not only will they go out onto the internet and find an answer if you don't give it to them, they'll find an answer that's from the dominant culture.
100%.
And I think as people who are in self-directed learning, we all agree that there is something about the dominant culture that is bad, right?
Yeah, that we don't like. That off. Doesn't pass the vibe check, Mel.
Exactly. Like, you know, if we're out here we're like, I'm a little bit sus about what's going on, you know, around me in these United States, you know? And if you're not willing to engage with that, even in the places where you personally feel uncomfortable, then you're not being a safe grown-up, basically. Yeah. You know, like,
yeah,
you're just reproducing other patterns of harm from our culture, and you're not aware of it. And we all do it, you know?
Yeah, like, yeah,
go
no.
Back to the making mistakes thing I was talking about earlier. I am not perfect. None of us are perfect. We're all going to make mistakes.
Yes. We're all probably going to harm someone who is of a marginalized existence. Because yeah. We are
someone
we
are who has less privilege than we yeah. are.
We're going to programmed.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, like, you know, what do you know? What do we each know about, you know, how to take accountability when harm actually happens? What do we know about how to change patterns that were previously invisible to us? You know, mm-hmm. like, these are all skills that can be learned.
Definitely. When you were talking about the language piece around, like, a young person asking what is trans, it reminded me of bringing on a young person in a space I was working in. And there was a questionnaire when you onboard and mm-hmm. one of the simplest questions is name and then followed by pronouns. And this young person had never heard of a pronoun before. Yep. So they weren't coming at the question from a, tell me what trans means or tell me what non-binary means. They weren't exploring anything that felt like anything really to them other than, oh, I've never heard that word. What does that mean?
Right.
And the other adult in the space, like, very neutrally, just like, kind of exactly the way you described it, like, within a matter of seconds, neutrally explained.
Yep.
And the child was like, huh, I didn't know that you could do that. I didn't know that that was possible. And they even right. like kind of asked a few questions that felt a little challenging, but mm-hmm. the adult didn't lose their neutrality and was yep. just like, no, this is how some people live. And they were like, huh, wow, I learned something new, and walked away. But they could have accepted something else as the truth, you know?
Yeah.
And having Absolutely. Someone who wasn't there to indoctrinate them or change their beliefs, they just very neutrally stated that this is an option that some people choose and that they had the option to choose that and they learned something new.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I frequently think about explaining it to six-year-olds, because if you can explain it to a six-year-old, you can explain it to anyone. Because, you know, their attention span is like, you got to get it right away. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's become this, like, highly politicized thing because there are transphobic people out there.
Right.
Who have latched onto this, like, one specific thing. I'm like, as a trans person, the pronouns are not the most important part for me. Like, they are an indication. If somebody, like, starts calling me she, then, like, I can tell that, like, they don't believe me about who I am. And that tells me something about this person, right?
Mm.
That's, like, useful to know. And in my decision making about whether or not I'm going to hang out with them, right? And spend right. my time with this person. But, like, being able, knowing someone's pronouns, I'm like, I like to know somebody's pronouns so that I know what they like to be called, you know? Like,
right.
you wouldn't like it if somebody pronounced your name wrong all the time. Like, right. it's the same kind of level of basic respect, you know?
Right. But maybe not so much as a full indicator and litmus test of what kind of person they are.
Right.
Yeah, just what they like to be called. And then you get to know them, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pronouns are tricky. They're really tricky.
They super can be. And here's my tip. If you're struggling with anybody's pronouns, if anyone in your life has changed their pronouns and, you know, it's like, you know it in your head, right? This is a thing I encounter a lot where people are like, no, when I think about you, it's just like when I talk, the wrong one comes out, right? Had this happen to me a million times too. The thing to do is, if you hear yourself say the wrong pronoun, or if the other person corrects you, you repeat the sentence verbatim with the right
Correct.
Pronoun and then just keep going.
Yes, yes.
And
yeah, I think that's great yeah, advice.
It'll help more than anything else.
Yeah.
Because you just need to retrain your mouth, you know?
Yeah, it's got to reach the wiring to the brain that's like, and that's where it comes out.
Yeah, and the
Yeah.
way that you will move the wiring is not by saying anything about the sentence, it's by saying the literal
The
sentence
correct sentence.
again.
Correct. Yeah.
And then if you can repeat it in your head to yourself like three times, that'll really help, you know, but
Maybe
it's a
write
process.
it down.
I find that most trans people I know, if you're able to catch yourself and be like, oh, sorry, and then like make the right sentence, like no one's gonna be
Right.
mad at you know? Which
Right.
I think is a lot of people's anxiety. They're like, oh, I don't want this person to be mad at me.
That's why I say they're tricky. They're not tricky for me to ever use linguistically in conversation. It is as smooth as drinking water for me. It's tricky in that everyone has a different desire on how important a pronoun is, and so I do think that it does create an anxiety for a lot of folks on how to do the, they want to just do the right thing, I think, a lot of times. They want to do the right thing.
For sure. I mean, and I'm several years in, I'm like almost 5 years into my transition. And I will say that in my experience, folks who are in the first year of transition are the most sensitive about it, you know?
Yeah, that's
And
understandable
like,
though.
it's a super vulnerable place to be. Yeah, exactly.
I can imagine it's very vulnerable, and you don't want to be misgendered or mislabeled or just perceived in any way other than what you want to be perceived as.
Right. You're feeling really insecure about whether or not people are actually perceiving you in that way. And like, you want to make sure that like you're legible to people and like your identity, but also like it's, you know, it becomes a trust thing that's complicated.
This
And
is
so, especially with kids, you got to get the kids' pronouns right. You know, like going back to the trust thing, if a kid tells you that their pronouns, like get them right and it will matter a lot to them.
Definitely. I think we should trust kids in that way. And let them explore. Don't delegitimize. Don't try to invalidate it. Don't ask them how long till the next name change or anything else. Like, I've heard so many of these ways that adults respond to these requests from young people, and I'm sorry, but they're all just wrong.
I agree. I think, you know, I think it's so easy to call someone what they want to be called as like a respect thing that it doesn't hurt anyone to try it, but it could really, really hurt someone to refuse to try.
100%. Oh, yes.
And I say this as a person who hasn't spoken to their father in 3 years. You know, so like think about, you know, parents who are unsure about it, like, you know, it may not be now, it may be later when they're an adult, but is that something that you really want? You know, like maybe they will change their name again, change their pronouns again, go back to their original name, whatever. We have no idea what the future holds. But it never costs you anything to show someone that you love them by calling them what they want to be called.
And I think this circles back around to the original thing we were talking about with giving children the space to choose their path, to choose what they want to do, to make their own mistakes, to make their own choices, to decide how they want to show up for today, for tomorrow, for every day after that. And it can be different every day. Surprise, surprise, we could change every day.
In fact, you will. That's the thing about being alive. If you are not changing then and growing, like that's part of being the definition of a living thing, right? Like trees don't stop growing until they die. Same with people.
This is all making me think about this quote that I read a few days ago. I don't know if you follow Erica Hart. They are a non-binary sex expert. The quote was, "To be trans invisible is to choose your joy over your safety." And I truly feel like everything that you've shared about yourself, that you have chosen your joy. You've found a community in a couple of communities to choose your joy and to express your joy and be yourself. And I hope that every person that is listening to this, if this is, reaching you and it feels like it's something for you, then it is. Like, choose your joy. And I know that that's so much easier said than done, but.
You know, it's been really important for me in my life because for many, many years, I was a very pretty blonde girl. And like that was important in the way that people perceived me. You know, like I was good at school, I had long blonde hair and blue eyes, and I was a white girl who like, you know, likes to chit chat with people, whatever. And I think that when I started coming out and like becoming the pink-haired weirdo that I am, you know, like I still think I'm pretty, but like I understand that conventionally, you know, I don't read the way that I used to, right?
Right.
And there were people in my life who were like, but you're giving all this up and what for what, you know? Like you have so many opportunities, you have so much, like you have everything that anyone could ever want. Why would you want something different? And like, I just felt like, oh, you're missing the point, like so bad, you know, like I'm so sorry for you. But like, it turns out that looking the way that people think that happy people should look, happy and successful people, mm-hmm. doesn't make you feel happy or successful if that's not how you feel.
Right.
And like, I'm not interested in winning at capitalism, you know, like I'm not trying to accrue the most points. And so like choosing my joy of like how great I feel when I go through the ritual of dyeing my hair, or how strong I feel when I, you know, pick up a heavy barbell or like haul myself up a big rock in a silly way, you know?
Yeah.
And like the joy that I feel getting to be in polyamorous relationship, getting to like dress up in silly outfits, you know, like to watch my body change as I like take hormone replacement therapy and I go through my second puberty, you know, which is kind of embarrassing, but also kind of cool. Like, no amount of access to normie spaces could have brought me the joy that the last 5 years of embracing my weird transness has. You know,
yeah.
I really felt like I was hiding for my whole life, and like I was hiding parts of myself so that people would like me. Yeah. And now the more myself I am, the more people I meet who are like, oh my gosh, like you're so cool like this. Like you're so authentic. How could you be so brave? I'm just like, it's a positive feedback loop. Like once you start, it's really hard to go back.
Yeah. I love that you found that for yourself. And I love that it all started at ALC New York City.
Oh,
I think
God.
That's just like a cherry on top.
I mean, a final story just to like, it really started there. So I mentioned there was a trans kid when I first started at the school. And I had been making like comments about like, I'm no lady for like a while. Until one morning he was like, hey Mel, can I ask you a question? And I was like, yeah, what's up? And this kid goes, do you consider yourself to be a cisgender person? And I was like, oh no. Like, I never would have asked myself that question, you know? And the way that it was asked to me, I have a thing where like, I don't lie to kids. Like, it's so important to me to always tell the truth to a child when they ask me that question. And so like all the like alarm bells in my head are going off like, you know, and I was like, I guess not. I have to go get some coffee. And I just like fled the room.
Oh my gosh.
So shout out to that kid, you know, for asking me that question. It really was the right one for the right moment. So thank you for that.
Well, before I let you go, do you have any last words of encouragement or advice for other facilitators, either in Agile Learning Centers or in any other self-directed spaces that could borrow from anything that you want to share?
Absolutely. I would say my piece of advice, my takeaway, is to find your joy and share it with children as much as possible. Like, find the places where your joy and the children that you're working with overlap, and then go and do that thing. And don't worry about if you're covering all the bases, all the subject areas, getting everything that they need. Just trust that by following the feelings of genuine curiosity, pleasure, enjoyment, mutual interest, that you will learn all of the things that you need to together.
That's perfect. That's absolutely perfect.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for spending all of this time with me. I really
appreciate it. Oh my God. This has been so fun.
I feel like we could chat for hours.
I really feel like we could keep going, but
I also feel like maybe like an in-person with like a cocktail or something and like a fire ring. I don't know why I'm envisioning that as well.
I love that. That sounds delightful.
I hope that you're enjoying the mountains and your break and your rest and your reset. And I wish you all the best in your future endeavors and whatever you're moving on to next. Thank you so much, Mel, for spending this time with me. I truly enjoyed it. I hope we can sit around a fire one day. Thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and took anything away and would like to share, please reach out to me. If you're a Spotify listener, you can respond with a voice note right inside the app, or you can find other ways to connect with me at theunschoolfiles.com. There you can also get direct access to the Discord community where I organize community events, special guests, support groups, coffee chats, all kinds of different things. You can also get a copy of any of the zines if you've missed those. All the digital zines are currently on sale for just $3. And additionally, you can also connect with me on Patreon directly from theunschoolfiles.com. I would love, love, love to make this work sustainable and keep showing up in this way. I would also like to cover all of my fees that I incur and compensate the folks that I partner with and bring more to you. So please consider partnering with me there. Everything is housed at theunschoolfiles.com. And until next time, stay kind to each other.